You're listening to the VeloNews Tour de France podcast, supported by Jaguar.
Hello, I'm Lionel Burney. I'm one of the three regular hosts of the cycling podcast. Richard Moore and Daniel Freeve are not with me today for this special VeloNews edition of the cycling podcast, but I am joined by VeloNews staffers Kaylee Fretz. Hello, Kaylee.
Hello.
And Andy Hood, otherwise known as Euro Hoodie.
Bonsoir.
Well, it's not bonsoir, Hoodie. Your French is good enough to know that it's the middle of the afternoon, or it's late lunchtime. I've just ordered lunch. We're in the centre of Gap, kind of the gateway to the Alps. But Kaylee, set the scene for us. Where are we?
Beautiful little square. You know, there's some water flowing behind your right shoulder. Small breeze. The Gap Ansay, I think we decided that's how it's said. Lovely little restaurant. Just had a little chicken with some citron. Fantastic.
Yeah, I've ordered a salad. First salad for a few days. It's been a heavy week food-wise. I've not managed to get out on my bike either this tour. I gave up bringing a bike to the Tour de France years ago. I'm not sure. Has Kaylee been out on his bike, Andy?
Just on the rest days. You know, it's 24/7. We live the tour, breathe the tour. There's no time for any sort of fun on during this Tour de France.
There isn't, but when you're cycling and the beautiful scenery, it's surely inspirational. It's thinking time, isn't it? It's still work, but it's thinking time, no?
Yeah, you can contemplate, you know, how you're going to write your stories, you know, what you're going to be doing, your next probing question. You keep squeezing a ride here and there, you know, 45 minutes in the morning, get up early, ride down some little, I call them the green squiggly lines on the Michelin maps. You just find some little road, there's no traffic. Little farmhouses, some cows. Really, it's good to blow out a little bit the legs and clear the mind.
Absolutely. Well, 2 weeks into the tour, everyone is starting to feel the fatigue. It's been a really hot tour as well, so sort of it's been tetchy a few times, hasn't it? In the post-race press conferences, there's been a little bit of needle between Chris Froome and the journalists over the repeated and quite one-dimensional questioning of his kind of power output and all of that. The narrative of the Tour de France seemed to have been steered into this one-way street here. Andy, you were at the Team Sky rest day press conference. What did you make of what Chris Froome and Dave Brailsford said today?
Yeah, today they did release some of their numbers from the first Pyrenean stage. Reasonable numbers, reasonable answers. I think they've handled themselves quite well, really. I mean, you know, in sharp contrast to, say, how perhaps Wiggins dealt with that question in 2012, you know, back in the day, Armstrong would just browbeat people down that even dared to ask a question. Or, you know, Contador, who just says, siguiente pregunta, won't even answer the question. You know, Froome has patiently answered every inquiry. He's never avoided a question. I think he's shown incredible composure, really, not letting it faze him at all. I guess that comes with perhaps having nothing to hide. I don't know.
The issue of the power numbers has been, well, it always comes up now, doesn't it? It's the new narrative of the Tour de France. France Télévision confronted Dave Brailsford with a very high power to weight ratio for Chris Froome, taken from the first Pyrenean mounted stage lap, Pierre Saint-Martin, over 7 watts per kilo. I'm not going to pretend that I really understand this science. This is obviously how the Tour de France is raced now. The performance analyst, Tim Kerrison, in this case at Team Sky, he's the man who's crunching those numbers, and they presented a figure that was below 6 watts per kilo. So somewhere between the estimation put out by French television and Team Sky's own number says there's a large discrepancy between those two. Kaylee, you're kind of you've got a very keen interest in the technical side of cycling and bicycles. Is this an area that you have had to educate yourself on, or do you have a sort of intuitive understanding of these numbers?
I have some understanding from my own racing years, actually, and quite a few years racing with power myself. And yeah, I mean, the disparity between those two figures is pretty huge, and I would guess that it's less on the watt side than the kilo side, because it's a ratio. And so if you change either of those numbers, you end up with a different different final number. Whether we're seeing Froome's true weight, I think, is a real question. Whether Sky is overestimating that and therefore dropping the watts per kilo, and French television is underestimating that and therefore raising the watts per kilo. I would guess that number it can really have a quite dramatic effect on your final watts per kilo figure, even just a couple kilos here or there. So I would guess that that's probably where a lot of the discrepancy is coming from.
Well, during the early days of the tour, we, Richard Moore and myself, caught up with Chris Froome in the Team Sky dining car one evening, and we asked him what his weight was, and that went out in a podcast which was only available to friends of the podcast, so it's behind our paywall, so it didn't get the perhaps the same exposure it would have done.
I'm a friend, so that's okay.
Well, yeah, so he said...
you have
he said,
to pay.
I paid my five.
Oh, this is music to my ears. This is contributing to my lunch here, Kayleigh. But Chris said he was 67 kilos was his kind of the weight he would be racing the Tour de France at. Now, the problem is that the era of suspicion is such that once you present this data, once Chris Froome says what his weight is, there's still an element of suspicion and scepticism about whether those numbers are accurate. I mean, is this moving us any further forward, do you think? Or do you think we're just kind of stuck debating the same story and not coming up to any real concrete conclusion?
Well, it's clear people can't get their heads around believing what they're seeing. They can't believe that Froome can get up the mountain as fast as, say, Pantani or Armstrong, whom we know now were doped to the gills. They can't get their heads around the idea that he can produce these numbers and do it in the era of the biological passport. People think that all the teams, all the cyclists are still doing the old tricks. They don't believe, they can't believe, they refuse to believe that perhaps the peloton has changed. Someone said to me on Twitter, said, every time I've believed in cycling, I've been disappointed. I think, and that's true, people have been disappointed with the sport for decades, and I think perhaps the peloton is a little bit further along than the perception in terms of the peloton has changed, I believe, quite dramatically, but the perception hasn't caught up with that new reality.
Well, one of the interesting aspects about Chris Froome is that is he the only rider in the Tour de France, Kayleigh, who's riding these oval-shaped chain rings, or are other riders using them?
I haven't taken a real close look at all of the bikes. There may be a Domestique somewhere using them, but he's definitely the only overall contender using them. The whole idea is that you essentially change the gear multiple times every...
That's very France, that, isn't it? A kid on a moped revving past, spoiling your eloquent explanation of the O-ring. So carry on, Kayleigh. Sorry.
That guy's been by three times already since we've sat down for lunch. The gear changes throughout individual pedal strokes. So the idea...
So sorry, explain that to me as I ride a bike, but I'm very much a layman. So say I'm on the big ring and it's got 52 teeth normally, right, and I'm on the small... on the sprockets, I'm say, I don't know, so say 52-21.
Right.
With the same number of teeth on the oval chainring, there's a... It's the effect of changing gear midway through a pedal stroke.
Yes, so the chainring itself is not round, and so the number of teeth is actually largely irrelevant. The actual, what's changing the gear is the distance between the center of the bottom bracket and where the chain is sitting on the chainring. So if the part of the oval chainring that is sort of fatter, that is higher, is effectively a taller gear, a bigger gear, than the parts that are shorter, and so yeah, you're effectively the gear is higher when your foot is in its most powerful position, so that's sort of like 90 degrees ish from the ground, and the gear is lower when your feet are straight up and down, where you can apply very little torque. That's the idea behind them.
And have you ridden them? Did it feel different to ride? Do your legs go round in a circle still, or did it feel quite jerky?
I haven't ridden the ones that Froome is on, the O-Symmetrics. I've ridden similar style from Roeder. They definitely take a little bit of getting used to. I don't feel that they have a real dramatic impact on the way that you spin. You feel them more climbing, and I, at least when I use them, I tended to run slightly lower cadence for some reason. But I didn't find them to have a real dramatic impact. And if you look at studies of them, the watts gained, the companies that produce them produce studies that say you gain quite a few watts, and other studies say you don't gain anything at all, and the science is definitely inconclusive there, and I think if it was more conclusive, you'd see a lot more than one major rider on them at the Tour de France.
So in layman's terms then, when you're at the top of the pedal stroke, you've got more to push down with, kind of thing, and then at the bottom of the pedal stroke, it's a light, feels like a lighter gear, or is a lighter gear. So
it is
it's an uneven pedal stroke, but maximizing the downstroke.
Right, because pedal strokes are uneven anyway. You can apply very little pressure to the pedals when your feet are straight up and down. You can apply quite a lot when they're sort of more horizontal. And so it's just taking advantage of where the strength lies in the human pedal stroke anyway.
So are you finding this whole watts per kilo debate, are you finding it's bringing in the Tour de France, which is a fantastic, varied, unpredictable event, it's turning it into quite a binary pursuit, isn't it?
Yes and no. I think just because I want to ride at 400 watts and, you know, I look at my power meter and say, ride at 400 watts, I could do that for about 4.5 minutes. So you still have to be able to produce the power, and I think that there is still a lot of room for riders to take advantage of spontaneity. And I think we've seen guys try to do that to Froome in the last week, and I think we will continue to see it in through the Alps. You know, if you can surprise someone and you can force them out of their comfort zone, maybe their power comfort zone, then you could do some real damage.
So generally, just wrapping up on the tech front, I mean, Sky, they have invested a lot in trying to find these tiny gains. They're by no means the only team that's doing that. Give us a sense of what some of the other teams are doing to sort of push forward, because it seems to me in the most recent years we've had quite significant steps forwards in the way that the bikes are produced and certainly the clothing that the riders are wearing. I mean, you only have to look back 5-6 years ago and everything's baggier, looser. Now it is absolutely skin tight. It may as well be sprayed on. Unpleasant image, I know, but there does seem to be a real sort of leap forward that we're going through at the moment.
Absolutely. I think the aerodynamic revolution happened. Well, it started happening quite a long time ago, but in the last 5 years or so, you're right, it's really taken off, and there's a lot more wind tunnel testing going on, and teams are realizing that things like clothing can actually have a real dramatic impact on aerodynamics, more so than wheels and bikes and all that stuff, actually. So teams are spending quite a bit of time and money on that. I know that Sky just picked up Robbie Ketchell from Cannondale Garmin. I believe he's still there. And he, at that team, was responsible for working with Castelli and developing a lot of the aerodynamic skin suits and race clothing that they use in the wind tunnel. And I think that team, even though they're not doing so well this year, that team actually started a lot of that technological movement, and Ketchell himself was responsible for quite a lot of that movement 5 years ago or so.
Andy, you've been covering the sport longer than me. I think this is tour number 20, what?
Number 19, actually.
Number 19, so close.
Don't be that old, man. Come on.
Well, I mean, you're kind of old school. You remember the good / bad old days. Does all of this leave you cold? Or do you find, you know, that when Chris Froome particularly comes into the nightly press conference, which he comes to do every day because he's in the yellow jersey, and he's asked all these questions, and there is this air of doubt and suspicion around him. When we talk to Kayleigh there about these tiny little gains that are being made by teams, and they're all doing it, you know, they're all looking for legal ways to improve performance. Do you understand why there's a kind of scepticism about, oh, well, it can't just be oval chainrings, oh, it can't just be skin-tight clothing, and the general idea that it's not all about the bike?
Oh, I can certainly understand it. The good old bad days, a lot of the old journalists were reminisced about the good old bad days, just in terms of how good those stories used to be. You know, the marginal gain stories, they're interesting on the tech side. They're quite fascinating, actually. But man, the old stories of the police raids and riders jumping out of windows and the doping doctors, you know, back in the day it was the doping doctor was the defining factor in a race, and now it's your trainer. So the sport has changed dramatically. I don't think it's fair to say that we missed the old days. I think the racing is more credible and really more exciting than it's ever been. I mean, you're seeing guys really suffering, having bad days, You know, even Chris Froome had a little wobble there in the 2013 Alpe d'Huez. So he's not immune to perhaps something happening bad to him in this last week of the Tour, even though he said today he felt better now than he did in 2013. But the sport's changed a lot. You know, it used to be like a spy, a lot of cloak and dagger kind of stuff, and now you have to have like a PhD in science technology to figure out what's going on.
Well, it seems to me that Velo News has got the perfect fusion between the kind of the old school here, Hoodie, and the scientific edge from Kaylee. Hoodie, do you tell Kaylee bedtime stories about the good old days, the police raid, police raids, and the doping stories? I'm not being flippant about it, but that's one way to, you know, one way to end the evening, isn't it? With a little glass of wine and a story from the old days.
Yeah, I think Kaylee's heard quite a few of my stories during this Tour de France. Gregor Brown has actually heard all of my stories. He's kind of sick of my stories, but Kaylee's the first time we've done a tour together, the whole tour, so. He's getting the full-on story treatment about, but the problem is a lot of times you can't remember what happened yesterday, so.
Well, talking of stories from the good old days, our colleague Richard Moore, who's not with us today, but he presented the last edition of the Velo News Cycling Podcast, and we'll probably be back for the next one, which will be produced, I think, from Paris or maybe from Alpe d'Huez, wherever we catch up next. But Richard, he produced an episode of our daily Kilometer Zero show with Cathy LeMond, wife, of course, of Greg LeMond, the American three-time Tour de France winner, most successful American ever to ride the Tour de France officially now. Officially, unofficially, cut it which way you like. But he caught up with Cathy, and while he was conducting that interview, Greg LeMond made a little cameo, which didn't make it into Kilometer Zero, but this is an amusing story from those good old days. I won't spoil it, but it does contain nudity, so if you're of a sensitive disposition, switch your ears off now.
Domaine de Roet, that's where I slept naked on a mattress in 1984 Tour de France. That's at the finish, and I could probably point out...
It was right in this, very near to where we are now.
It was probably right here, butt naked.
One of the famous Greg LeMond stories, which I remember, is from this area. Greg has stripped off in the camper van because he's too hot. And this is something you used to do at dinner with your teammates, take your top off.
Yeah, I'm always running hot, no air conditioning, so I would sweat for 2 hours after the race. And all my other...
Which I imagine went down well with the French. They don't, you know, they're not into manners at dinner or anything like that, are they?
No, they're pretty good. They're pretty relaxed. And I was... probably prefer that than sweating all over everything. So
you slept naked, butt naked, in the grounds of this hotel, and woke up, I think, when the sun had risen and there were people, families, milling around.
Yeah, we didn't. I guess I didn't really quite understand where we were located because it was so hot in the room. So I grabbed the mattress. I hate to say it, I sleep naked, usually with a sheet on me.
Not a sheep.
Not a sheep. A sheet. And it was so hot. By the time I was just sweating, I pulled the thing out. You know, pulled it out into, it was basically dirt and some grass, and I woke up the next morning, sun out, and the sheet was not on my body because it was too hot, and there were people, families, and kids all around me.
And kids saying, what's that? That's a Tour de France cyclist.
Thank God there's no social media. That's all I can say. It would have been a horrible experience.
Especially as a kid, man. I was kind of wild.
You're listening to the Velo News Tour de France podcast, supported by Jaguar.
This is a Velo News edition of the Cycling Podcast. I'm Lionel Burney. I'm with Kaylee Fritz and Andy Hood of Velo News outside a little bistro in the centre of Gap. Just finishing off lunch, brief respite on the rest day. The Alps start tomorrow, or the Alps proper start tomorrow, and the Tour de France concludes on Sunday in Paris, of course. Andy, one of the things we've noticed about the Tour de France press room is that the sizable American contingent has dwindled, and I think Velo News is certainly the only niche publication with staff members here from start to finish. I mean, what could possibly have accounted for this swing in representation?
One name, one report, Lance Armstrong and the USADA anti-doping report. Armstrong was the boom of all booms in cycling for the United States. There was a bandwagon that the media hitched on to, and we saw massive, biggest, largest amounts of American journalists ever at the tour in the Armstrong run. All the mainstream media got onto it, all the big dailies were sending people over. 2005, of course, Lance retired. It was curious, though, when he came back in 2009, there was less media simply because of the newspaper crisis. You know, newspapers are dying on the vine in the United States. People just didn't have the money. You know, covering the tour is expensive. You know, it's basically $10,000. A lot of money for a newspaper these days to send a correspondent over to the tour. I think that's probably almost bigger factor, really, than even the doping. It's just too expensive. The United States newspaper industry is in dire straits right now. But it's kind of you guys are living the boom right now in the UK with Wigo, Team Sky, Froome. I've never seen so many palms in my life, actually.
Yeah, they'll be doing roast beef in their press buffet very soon with Yorkshire pudding. If you're not familiar with that, do check it out next time you're in the UK visiting on holiday, which I'm sure every one of our listeners from the States will be flocking to the UK for a holiday. There are some green shoots of sort of recovery with American cycling, but it's not been a smooth kind of transition from the post-Armstrong era for any of those young guys. I suppose there's still a big shadow, but in Taylor Finney, Andrew Talansky and TJ Van Garderen, three of the most promising young riders of any nationality, the problem is Taylor Finney's had a very bad accident and has been out of action. Andrew Talansky, I mean, his tour has not gone anything like the way we would have expected, riding for Cannondale Garmin. Really one of the first of the major names to be dropped on the climb to La Pierre Saint-Martin in the Pyrenees. Kaylee, can you shed a bit of light on what's going on with Andrew Talansky?
What's going on? I don't know. He hasn't really opened up and said there's a problem. I think he just doesn't really have the legs. You know, he had illness sort of around the Tour of California, pretty serious. They said it was allergies, but I think it was more serious than that. And it might have, you know, disrupted his preparations a little bit. Had a not so great ride at the Dauphiné, and so things were not looking good coming into the tour. And then, yeah, that first day after the rest day, he said he just had rest day legs and just lost heaps of time that day. And hasn't, you know, he's been riding much better since then, but it's still not up to his usual standard. He's been coming in sort of the group behind the GC group almost every day. And why that is, I don't really know. I don't think he knows.
Well, Cannondale Garmin across the board have had a tough time. It's not for the want of trying, though. I mean, Daniel Martin had a go on the stage to Courtrai, trying to chase down Rafał Majka. We've seen Ryder Heiserdahl in a break. We've seen Christian Corrin in a break. But to carry that on, they're just not catching a break, are they?
No, they really aren't. I think Martin's been second twice already this race. Nathan Haas is in a break as well, and you know, they've hit a bunch of the breakaways. I don't think they've hit any of the successful ones yet. So maybe it's just bad timing. You know, they missed a couple of the really good ones, or had the wrong rider in it, perhaps. Yeah, they just can't catch a break. I would look for Heiserdahl in particular over the next couple of days to jump in one of the moves that might survive over the Alps. And, you know, that's a guy that, well, he's won the Giro. You can't really ever count him out of anything. So if he gets in a move with 15 guys and they give him a bunch of time, no reason why they can't finally take a stage in this last week.
Andy?
You know, Garmin is kind of a soft spot for a lot of people in the States. It's a team that's kind of is almost our team in a lot of ways, an American team. I mean, Waters was quite brave in building that team. You know, he was one of the first guys to stick his neck out and say that, you know, we're going to try to do this in a clean way. Built kind of an unconventional platform for that team. It's not without its problems. You know, there's always the whispers sometimes that the team sometimes is misdirected in the sense of its priorities. They always bring this kind of a mixed squad to the Tour de France. It's almost like they're throwing darts at a dartboard. See if it sticks, but that team's been able to deliver some huge results over the years. It's not a powerhouse like a Sky or a Movistar that's going to be consistent in every race they go to win, because a lot of that reason is the budget. You know, they just don't have the £26 million of Sky and Katusha, so you know they just don't have the money to throw down to buy even not just the superstars, but all the support riders that come with that and the support staff behind the riders. But Waters has delivered some huge wins throughout his tenure at that team. And, you know, Roubaix, Liège, the Giro, tour stages, you know, chapeau to them. As Kaylee just said, you know, Ryder, he's going to go for it. I mean, Ryder wants to win a stage of the tour. He'll be sticking his neck into the wind in the Alps for sure.
Well, they'll certainly have a bit of freedom to do that. You mentioned budgets there. I mean, the other, I know they're not an American team, but BMC Racing, they've got an American kind of gloss to them, haven't they? They've got the big budget, the big bus. They've got the big bad daddy of American cycling, Jim Okovitz. For legal sakes, let's not talk too much about him. They've got TJ Van Garderen, who currently is riding very high. I mean, a flawless first 9 days in the Tour, which I think you talked about in the first Velo News Cycling podcast. It couldn't have gone better. I mean, they put not a foot wrong, and you know, to win the opening time trial with Rowan Dennis, take the yellow jersey, win the team time trial, keep TJ out of trouble. I mean, some of us were a bit mystified at the way they were riding the finale in the flatter stages, you know, all coming to the front and sort of showing their grunt and muscle with the sprinters teams, but really perfect way to keep TJ Van Garderen out of trouble. And then on the morning of the Stade de la Pierre Saint-Martin, I spoke to Max Chiandri, and they were playing it very cautiously and saying, you know, we're going to follow. I know that Sky's policy when it came to trying to distance Van Garderen, and they knew that any sharp accelerations, sharp attacks, just 3-4 second increases, real severe increases in pace would unsettle Van Garderen, who's much more of a rhythm climber, much steadier climber. But he's still there, and although the sharks are lining up behind him, there's still got to be a chance of a podium in Paris, hasn't there, Kayleigh?
Absolutely. I'm just pulling up the results because I don't remember the times, but I think he has 30 seconds on, almost exactly 30 seconds on Valverde. That will be his primary struggle over the next week, is to keep those 30 seconds over Valverde. I think that if he can just continue to ride his rhythm, then it's a possibility to stay on that podium. I think staying in the top five is, you know, barring catastrophe, almost assured at this point. He was actually very much looking forward to the Alps, which I think is a good sign. You know, he didn't, like you said, the everything up to this point has been perfect for that team. He hasn't had to waste a single bit of energy that he didn't want to. You know, he hasn't gone in the attack. He hasn't thrown down with some of the other guys that are trying to take time out of Froome. He's just been sitting there doing his own thing the entire time. So maybe that means he comes into the Alps a little bit fresher than those guys and can hold off, you know, a rider with quite a lot of panache and quite a lot of class like Valverde.
I won't say it's been a bad Tour for BMC at all, because it certainly hasn't, but yet, Andy, they don't quite punch the weight of the budget, do they? I mean, they are such a powerful team, and yet, you know, they didn't bring Philippe Gilbert here because I think they thought maybe he would distract from the overall plan of trying to get Van Garderen on the podium. Greg Van Avermaet won a stage, but he's another one who doesn't really conform. They don't ride quite the same way as Sky, do they? It's not all for one goal. They've got a bit more flexibility.
Yeah, BMC, you know, they just don't have that perhaps Contador or Chris Froome. They're trying to develop TJ into that, but I think until he kind of reaches that next level, I mean, he's okay, he's top five, but even by his own admission, TJ says he's not quite the level of the Fab Four, whatever you call him. He's kind of right behind that. So for him to get that podium this year would be a huge step forward and perhaps allow him to have even more support on that team, because right now the team kind of does have to cover its bets a little bit. I mean, they've won 3 stages, they've had a yellow jersey, so their Tour is a success no matter what happens with TJ, whereas you know, say if Tinkoff Saxo, Birdie's not going to be on the podium, could be kind of almost viewed as a disaster for that team.
Yeah, even though Peter Sagan is going to win the green jersey and Rafa Mike has won a stage, everything still seems to focus on Contador because he's been there and he's done it, whereas Van Garderen is still very much on the upward curve, I guess. What's his profile like in the States at the moment? Perhaps Kayleigh's better placed to answer that one because you're based there.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm never in the U.S. in July, which I think is when most people will gain an opinion of TJ. I know that he didn't come across great on television over the last couple of years. You know, I would come home and just riding friends and things like that would tell me that, you know, his interviews are kind of whiny and things like that, and I would try to explain that he's actually a very nice guy when you get him in person, when you get him away from a television camera. But I think he's been better. I've watched, well, most of the NBC interviews that he's done. You know, we've had a recorder in there as well and trying to get questions in. So he is answering questions intelligently, and I think he's probably coming across better on television. So hopefully the American audience is coming around to TJ a little bit. He does not inspire the way that some others do, and I think that's probably because of his riding style, sort of a Levi Leipheimer-esque riding style, just sort of following wheels and, you know, not one to really throw down. And those kind of moves are definitely what inspire a real fan base, I think. You know, that's why people love Contador. That's why people love Quintana, because he's not afraid to try. I think TJ is really more focused on, let's get me on the podium, and then hopefully over the next couple of years, let's get me a yellow jersey, and then, you know, I can start attacking like a wahoo.
I mean, that's a really interesting point you make about how somebody comes across to their home audience, in your case, thousands of miles away. We have a little bit of that with the UK coverage, and I have the exact same thing when I come home from the tour. People have always raved about Wiggins, raved about Cavendish, because they come across with such sort of feisty, zesty personalities, whereas Chris Froome does seem to say the same thing every day. And people watching the tour on television, they want a bit more of a story around the people who are doing well. I know, Kayleigh, you copped a bit of heat on Twitter for saying that Chris Froome's first press conference that was a little bit interesting was the one where he was talking about having the cup of urine sprayed over him, as he claimed happened the other day. And I could see exactly what you were saying. It was the first time we'd seen Chris Froome animated as a human being rather than a sports quotes robot who comes in and says, yeah, a real tough day out there, the guys were magnificent, the real tough day out there, the guys were magnificent. I mean, as journalists, particularly you guys working in words, that makes it hard, doesn't it, Hoodie? I mean, you're a quotes machine. You latch on to anything that sounds a little bit out of the ordinary. You must find Chris Froome a little bit hard work at times.
Oh, you certainly do. That's when you go talk to Garen Thomas. You just say, okay, well, Chris Froome was not going to say anything interesting today. Let's go talk to Garen Thomas or Nico Roche. You know, there's a lot of guys around Froome that you know, are a little more expressive, perhaps. But it's funny though with how the perception of these writers are. I know that, of course, we hear all the stories about Wiggins. Some of those stories too with the Cavendish, such fiery, zesty personalities don't always mean happiness inside the team bus, where these guys with Froome, they'll cut their legs off, cut their arm off to help Chris Froome win this tour. You don't see that division inside these teams with some of these guys, and TJ's the same way, kind of quietly building up confidence, you know, proving himself. He has to prove himself first to these guys before they really throw down and really help him win the tour. And that's where I think both Froome, you know, Froome is obviously past that, but that's where TJ is right now. He has to kind of reconfirm to even inside that team bus that he's capable of doing it, because these guys go out there and, you know, I mean, cycling so hard. There's nothing worse for a cyclist to go out there and bury yourselves and then have Christoph finish third in the sprint. How was the dinner that night at the Katusha table? I mean, come on.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. Well, fellows, it's time to wrap up. You've got a long afternoon of work ahead of you. America will be waking up and expecting its Velo news. So you'd better be uploading to the internet and sending across to the office all the stuff from the rest day. Don't want to make a rod for your back, but you know, no, there's no time for chilling out at a restaurant anymore. But before we go, I was going to ask who's going to finish on the podium in Paris, but that's a little bit too easy, I think. So I will go for name two of the four Alpine stage winners coming up in the next four stages. We've got what have we got? We've got Pralou, which is a second category, quite a gnarly second category uphill finish. We've got the finish over the top and down into Saint-Jean-de-Maurienne. We've got the finish at La Toussuire, which is probably the hardest of the actual finishing climbs. And then obviously the iconic Alpe d'Huez, short, sharp and brutal, I suspect, on Saturday. Kayleigh, I'll come to you first. Two of the stage winners.
Well... I'll stick with Hegedal for one of them. I think he's going to go off the front, and that'll be out of a breakaway. And then I think Quintana will win on Alpe d'Huez, and I don't want to call it a gift, but I think Froome may fail to chase that one down.
Okay, and Andy?
I will say that Froome will win an Alpe d'Huez on the yellow jersey to emphatically stamp his authority on the tour. And I think... I think Quintana will win a stage, La Tuisier.
Okay, well, from us on the Cycling Podcast, if either of those guys win, if you get one winner, you get a small beer, and if you get two winners, you get a large beer on us. Our generosity knows no bounds. So let's wrap it up there. There'll be a final Velo News edition of the Cycling Podcast at the end of the race. If you've enjoyed this and you're new to us, check us out on thecyclingpodcast.com. We broadcast every day from the tour. We do a couple of shows. We do a regular wrap-up show after the stage, and we do Kilometre Zero, which is a sort of sideways look at a different aspect of the tour every weekday. You can check us out on iTunes and listen to all of those. They won't have dated, the Kilometre Zero shows. They'll be just as relevant as they were when they first hatched. And we broadcast live on the Wednesday of the Tour de France. So we've got one more live show to come on Wednesday. I'm not even sure what time it will be in America. There's so many different time zones. It'll be on live at some time in America. If you want to check us out on the internet, thecyclingpodcast.com. All that remains for me, Lionel Burney, to say is thank you very much, Kaylee.
Thank you.
And thank you very much, Andy.
Merci beaucoup.